Can Max Fried, Devin Williams, and Cody Bellinger collectively replace Juan Soto with the Yankees? Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Wednesday, December 18th, your source of news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. Follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Troy Brock, Troy B Baseball on the Twitter machine. And Troy, I want to get to this pitcher injury report that was released by MLB. I want to get to Rob Manfred's comments about how deferrals can be problematic a little bit. But first, we got to talk about the big trade from Tuesday, late afternoon, evening, whatever. We've talked about it a couple times as it could potentially happen. Cody Bellinger officially goes from the Chicago Cubs to the New York Yankees. The Cubs are chipping in $5 million along with that. And they're getting back AAA reliever Cody Poteet. Swingman, technically, he made a couple starts for the Yankees last season. But is this addition, adding Cody Bellinger, who they have said is going to play center field, combined with signing Max Fried and signing Devin Williams, it's a collective $45.4 million next year. Does this do enough to replace Juan Soto on the lineup where the Yankees can still make another World Series push in 2025?
I don't know if a World Series push is possible with some of the other teams in the American League also improving over how they performed in 2024, but I do think that those three players do come very close to replacing Juan Soto, and they're doing it at a $10 million cheaper price tag for three players combined as opposed to just the one player. But yeah, I still think it's going to be hard for the Yankees to make it back to the World Series. I think that they kind of coasted on a weak American League side of the bracket to the World Series, but we'll see what can happen in 2025.
Yeah, and I think the money thing is interesting. We heard a lot of conversation about there was an impasse here between the Cubs and the Yankees. We got some reporting from John Heyman after the deal was done. The Blue Jays were also interested in getting Bellinger, and that was one of those things that helped the Cubs keep their total financial contribution to just $5 million. It's $2.5 million for 25, and then another $2.5 million that will either help cover part of the buyout if he opts out, or help cover part of the 26 salary if he does not opt out, which it feels like Bellinger is probably not going to. And I think my question here is, why would the Blue Jays want Cody Bellinger? You have Dalton Varsho in center. You have Vlad Guerrero at first. I don't think any other contender had the same need for Cody Bellinger that the Yankees did. And so the Blue Jays are either saying after the fact, oh, we were interested just to try to placate their fans because they haven't done anything, or the goal was to try to drive the Yankees' price up and like, okay, yeah, they took a little bit more salary on. They're the freaking Yankees. They don't care. So like, I don't want to talk too much about the Blue Jays in this, but like for the Yankees, this was the best possible outcome, was getting Bellinger without having to give up anything really of note other than money, right?
Right, absolutely. And as you said, they're the Yankees. The money doesn't matter to them. They can spend right along with the Mets and the Dodgers. And Cody Bellinger, we've talked about it, he fits their part perfectly with his batted ball profile, and he's a left-handed power hitter that pulls, and
he's a power hitter anymore, but I mean, he can hit 20 home runs. He did have like a surprisingly like below average pull rate last year, but like Juan Soto didn't have a great pull rate. He was more all fields before he went to New York, and they fixed that really quickly with the short porch. So I think they'll fix that. But what I think, not to speak for you, it sounds like you're trying to say like he could be successful in New York.
Right, absolutely. And yeah, I agree. He's not the power hitter that he once was 6-7 years ago. But where he had 18 home runs in 2024. I think that if he would have played all of his games in Yankee Stadium, he would have had 24 home runs in 2024. So an increase of six if he would have played all of his games. And adding, you know, another 20 home runs to this lineup, that gives the team another guy that can hit 20 home runs. And, you know, outside of Aaron Judge, who you know is going to hit 45-plus every year, Giancarlo Stanton is questionable on if he's even going to play enough to hit 20 home runs or more every year. Jazz Chisholm, maybe. It depends on how he's feeling when he wakes up in the morning. And then other than that, Volpe's not hitting 20. Let's see. Austin Wells probably isn't hitting 20. Dominguez, maybe, if they put him in the lineup. Oswaldo Cabrera ain't. And Ben Rice, maybe. But with Cody Bellinger in Yankee Stadium, he's another guy that as long as he stays healthy, you can mark down and pin 20 or more home runs from him.
Yeah, it feels like this is the best option they could have had because just how terrible the center field market is. They needed a lefty hitter who could be towards the top of the lineup. They needed a good defender, and they needed some power. And you get two out of the three with Cody Bellinger. Center field, this free agency is a wasteland. There's just nobody of note here. And I think there is a world where you see Bellinger at first base, but they're smart to come out and say he's going to play center so that they can try to get all of these first basemen who are still in the market. Cause there's actually decent first basemen, whether it's Alonzo, whether it's Christian Walker, even a guy like Carlos Santana, who would be a good defensive first baseman. There's options out there. And what I like now is you have both Jazz Chisholm and Cody Bellinger, who can play infield and outfield, really probably almost anywhere you put them for Jazz, at least. Cody's not playing short or anything, but they can play wherever you put them at their positions and at least be slightly above average, right? Like, I'm not worried. They threw Jazz at third, and Jazz was fine. He wasn't amazing, but he was fine. And so I feel like you have the ability. Jazz is at second. You can move Jazz to center if you need to. Cody can play first or center. Dominguez can play left or center. You've got Grisham on the roll. Like, you have a lot of options here, and the defense should be much better than it was last year when you had Judge miscast in center field. He was one of the worst defensive center fielders in baseball. He wasn't terrible, but he wasn't additive to center field, right? And it's much better all around. For the Cubs side of this, was this also the best possible outcome? Like, I've seen people say, oh, the Cubs got fleeced. It's like, no, they didn't. They shed the contract and probably the 26th liability for $5 million. They paid the buyout now instead of paying the buyout next offseason. And they got a potentially useful swingman in return.
Yeah, I agree. I think that getting rid of as much salary as possible was the biggest thing here for the Cubs. And I think I saw that they now have $90 million roughly available to still spend in free agency this offseason, and compared to where their payroll was last year.
They just have to do it.
Yeah, they have to do it. And they have made moves with trades, but they need to bring in somebody through free agency and spend some of that $90 million that they have available.
I feel like the needs of this team now is they could pencil Matt Shaw in at third. I do feel like maybe there's a trade there for a third baseman or a sign. I don't think they should sign a guy like Bregman. You and I both think Bregman's not going to be that great going forward, but this rotation, Shota Imanaga, Justin Steele. I like both of those guys. They both pitched right around a 3 ERA last year. I like the potential of Matthew Boyd. I've got workload questions about he threw 40 innings last year. But then, like, Jameson Taillon, 3.27 ERA. It felt a little fluky last year on that. Javier Assad, you know, threw 147 innings. I think he's fine, but, like, I don't think it would hurt to go get another stud for this rotation. And I think that's the big question people have. The bullpen as well. Your only lefties, I think Luke Little is really probably your only lefty, unless they just have a random guy up for like long relief or something. It feels like a top line starter and or a prominent lefty for the bullpen, Tanner Scott maybe, would be a great fit here for the Cubs. I think the big thing is here they can't be done. They can't just stand pat now and say, we got rid of Bellinger, We still have an extra outfielder because Seiya Suzuki is going to be our DH, but he can play the outfield if we need him to. I don't think they can be done. They've got to keep adding. One, from a payroll perspective, right? Like you said, they have like $60 million, I think, before they get to last year's spending, which was 228. They're at 174 right now per Fangraphs. But then also, like, they've got it, like, they've got Shota Imanaga has a player option for 2026. I mean, he could very well walk if he doesn't think that the team's doing enough to stay competitive, right? And so this is definitely a situation where the Cubs can't be done because the National League feels like it, at least their path through the Central feels like it could be more open than it's been in a while with the Brewers continuing to subtract.
Right. And they've been linked to add another starter in Jesus Luzardo. But again, that's another trade. That's not getting somebody through free agency. And honestly, with how good their infield defense is, how great would Corbin Burns look in this rotation?
In front of that infield. Stick it to the Brewers by taking their guy who they had to trade away because they knew they couldn't re-sign him. The Cubs go in after taking their manager and then take their former ace.
It's crazy. He's pretty heavily linked to the Giants and as well the Blue Jays. I know we're not really talking the Blue Jays much. I think I'm kind of with you. I think they're just kind of trying to drive the price up on all of these people that they're so-called in on because they've also had the rumors surrounding trading Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette. Why would those rumors be a thing if they're also in on all these big-time free agents and big-time names in the trade market? It's weird. That's another story for another episode. But yeah, I'm with you. I still think the Cubs need to do more. I do think that they have pretty much claimed the National League Central title for 2025, assuming this roster stays healthy. But as far as being a World Series contender, I think they need to do a little bit more to contend with the teams in the National League East and National League West.
Yeah, they're just not quite there yet. Okay, so moving on a little bit, we did see from Rob Manfred went on a podcast because sure, okay, Rob Manfred went on a podcast, whatever, and he talked about deferred money, been a big talking point from fans this offseason because of the Dodgers. They have over $1 billion deferred. $680 million of that is Shohei Ohtani's money. And the quote that everybody's pulling out of this is he said deferrals, quote, can be problematic. And he specifically talked about the Arizona Diamondbacks, who earlier in, 2004, they had like $254 million in deferred salaries. Jerry Colangelo, the primary owner, got forced out by the minority owners, and the team was sold. And are deferrals inherently a problem in the sport, or is it because of the significance of the Shohei Ohtani deferrals, how much of his deal is deferred. Is that why people are saying deferrals are an issue?
I think that the biggest issue about it comes from it's kind of a way to skirt around the luxury tax. And while they are already over the luxury tax, it still lowers their payroll from what it should be for the actual total amount of the contract. I know there's some kind of weird math that the Players Association did that instead of it being $2 million on their payroll, it's $46 million.
But the total contract, it's the present value of the deferred money. So like $70 million in 10 years is worth like $46 million now. And so the CBT hit is the $46 million. The real advantage to the Dodgers, I think the issue here is we have to take Shohei out of it because that's such a weirdly unique deal, right? No interest, which almost never happens. These guys always have interest built into these things. No interest on the money. 68 of his $70 million a year is deferred. And just to kind of clarify for folks watching who don't quite know about how this works, you have to fund that deferred money. The money, the $68 million for 2024, has to be in account by July 1st, 2026, right? You have until a year and a half after the season to actually fund the money for that season. You can't just pawn this off a decade later and try to figure it out. Now, you have to fund that present day value, and you can invest that money in things like that with the understanding that you can keep the difference in the, you know, the difference of what is made above what you have to pay Shohei, right? You have to be able to pay him $68 million a year. Anything after that, you can keep it. But if the investments underperform, you have to cover that money as well. Like, he gets, Shohei gets his money no matter what. But I think if you take Shohei out, which is really, it's really just a tax thing, right? Because he'll be in Japan by the time he collects that money, he won't pay Japan taxes on it. It was the same thing with the signing bonus for Blake Snell. He got 50-something million dollars in signing bonus while he was living in Seattle that doesn't have state tax. He saved himself, I think I saw like $5.5 million in California state taxes by not living in California when he got the signing bonus. If you take Shohei out of this, is it still a huge issue if they're making you pay the CBT on what the deal would have been worth had you not deferred the money?
I think it all comes down to still it's the contract, regardless of however much they spent it or however they fudge the numbers. It's a 10-year for Shohei specifically. It's a 10-year contract, $700 million. I don't have, that's the only one I know off the top of my head. I don't know the figures for the other ones. Yeah. So that's why.
And all the rest are weird because they have interest and stuff in them. Right. Either. Yeah.
But that's then. So I'm using that one as an example. So instead of just saying your payroll tax is $70 million a year for X amount of time, they're lowering it. And so their payroll is lower in the long run, and it's not, they have more space to spend towards their, before they hit their collective bargaining tax. Yes, it's the Dodgers. They've already passed it, but still they would be even farther past it than they would be. And so I think that it's just, it's, there has to be something that, because having over $1 billion in deferred payments is just it's insane, and
it's a lot. Yeah,
they're the only team that is doing it to this level. Yes, other teams do it. No other team is doing it to this level.
I believe even if you take Shohei out, the Dodgers have more money deferred than any other team in baseball, or I guess any two or three teams in baseball put together. Yeah, I do think that it is probably relevant, and I guess we'll use Shohei as an example. A lot of the projections when he went in the free agency last offseason were 10 years, $440 million, 10 years, $450, $460. So I don't think he would have gotten $700 million were it not for the deferrals, right? Like, I think he would have if his deal was 10 years, $460 million, I don't think any of us would have really blinked an eye. The bigger deal to me, I think you have an argument if you want to, not you, just like in general, if you want to say there should be a rule about the maximum percentage that you can defer, right? Because the Shohei situation, even if you ignore the CBT aspect, they're paying him $2 million a year in actual cash, which means they have more cash to sign other players because they now have time for all of the extra Shohei advertising, marketing, merchandise money to come online to actually fund his deferred money. There was one report that claimed the Dodgers have made over $100 million just on having Shohei already, which would pay for, you know, two seasons of his present value deferred money into that account. I do think there's a like if there should be a rule about the percentage of the deal that can be deferred. You shouldn't be able to do 90-something percent of the money deferred. But on the whole, I understand the tax implications and the tax benefits. It helps them get around the state taxes that other states don't have to deal with, Texas, Seattle, things like that. And I think the big thing we all kind of forget is minus the Shohei deal, because not everybody could do that Shohei deal. But minus that, anybody else could defer money as well, right? I was doing some work today on something. There's a $5 million buyout for a pitcher. And I want to say maybe it was somebody with a weird clause. Like he could give up his buyout to void a club option or something like that. But the buyout itself was deferred for $5 million a year for 5 years. Kind of weird. Maybe it was Sonny Gray. It was Sonny Gray, I think. Yeah, he could. Sonny Gray could give up the $5 million buyout that was all deferred money to void his option, his club options. The team picked it up. Anybody could defer money. It's just nobody's really saw fit to aggressively lean into the deferrals, except for the Dodgers. Ever since we saw the Nationals do it with Scherzer and Strasburg and all those guys, right? Does it make sense? Would it make you feel better if they had a rule that said no more than 20 or 25% of the contract can be deferred?
Yeah. I think honestly, because there's a rule in place. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but there is a rule in place where players cannot take a certain percentage in decreased payment year over year. Like they can't take a cut in pay, a certain amount of cut in pay. It's like 12 or 13% they have to make within that range year over year. And do that. Like it whatever Shohei's pay was, you can defer. If Shohei made $40 million in 2020 before signing this contract, you're paying him $70 million. You can defer all the way down to $38 million or $35 million.
Right.
And that be that. But yeah, going from 70 million to 2 million, that's
wild. That's
freaking insane.
That is absolutely wild. And he's probably the only player that has enough endorsement money in baseball that can actually do that, right? Like nobody else can make that happen. Another big story that kind of came out was MLB released their report on injuries to pitchers. And I say released their report. The general public doesn't have access to the actual report, but a lot of sports writers did. And so Jeff Pass and a couple of people wrote up some of the stuff. And one of the big takeaways is it's kind of things that we knew, but it put it into better. It put it into just numbers in more stark terms. Chasing max effort velocity and spin rates is driving the increase in injuries. And, you know, this goes from pitchers trying to just throw harder in general. The average fastball velocity and the max fastball velocity, those two numbers have been coming closer and closer together over the last decade. Pitchers are trying to develop just nastier pitches through pitch design with edgetronic cameras and all that stuff. And then like max effort training, max effort pitching in games. The big thing that kind of like, I feel like we knew that already, but the big thing that I think shocked me more so than anything else was in that same story. They were talking about how all of these issues have trickled down to the youth level. And so the Perfect Game National Showcase, they had a chart, the number of players who were throwing 95 miles an hour from every year from 2014 through this year. And in 2014, five kids, these are high schoolers, were throwing 95 or more miles an hour. This year, it was 36. Here's the issue that I have, or I guess not the issue. Here's my concern. The thing that came out of this was, in essence, pitchers need to not throw as hard, right? But every incentive in the game and on the path to get to the game, to get drafted, to get a college scholarship, is based on how hard you throw, because we've shown the harder you throw, generally, within reason, the more effective you are. How do you fix this without trying to put in some sort of dumb rule that says any pitch over a certain mile an hour counts as a ball? Like, how do you fix this short of just saying any pitch harder than 96 is a ball?
Yeah, I really don't know how you fix this, because it's if they do pitch slower, it's going to increase the offense and to a level that it's already been increasing year over year for a while now. Even with the dead ball, for supposedly dead ball for most of this season, Aaron Judge hit 58 home runs. So
I think on average, like batting averages and things like that are falling and stuff, but we see those outlier things where some dudes are just going nuts. But like, it feels like, and at the same time, in that same interview, Manfred also talked about the prominence of the starting pitcher. This feel like correct me if I'm wrong, this feels like a possible solution. You can't legislate pitch speeds or spin rates or whatever. I've seen dumb ideas like any pitch harder, whatever RPMs is the ball. That's stupid. Don't do that. But what if MLB said, like, you publish your starting lineup before the game, right? And it's, here's your nine guys who are batting and here's your bench and whatever. What if you had to declare five pitchers and those are your five pitchers for the game? And if your starter goes five innings or six innings, great. You can use each of those relievers for an inning and you're done. But if your starter only goes three, those remaining four guys have to cover the last six innings. Is a rule like that, where, and you have to have a caveat, if a dude is hurt and has to leave the game, you can put somebody else in, but like they got to go on the IL or something. You can have rules about that. Is a rule like that, is there a possibility that that could incentivize pitchers to find ways to pitch more innings and inherently restrict themselves a little bit from max effort so that they can cover more innings?
Yeah, I think so. And I like that rule a lot. I'm a big starting pitching guy. And so to me, that rule would definitely alleviate that. And you'd start seeing starting pitchers go longer like they used to do. And you'd start seeing more guys cross that six, seven inning threshold per start and having multiple guys over 200 innings. I mean, it was only 30 years ago. We had Greg Maddux throwing 89 miles an hour and he was winning Cy Youngs throwing 89 miles an hour. And I know that guys are a lot better. We have a lot more analytics and things that teach guys how to hit home runs at a higher rate and how to improve your launch angle and your exit velocity. And I'm not asking for pitchers to go out and throw 89 miles an hour, but it works. If you know how to actually pitch, you can make it work without throwing your arm at the guy as hard as you can and just hoping that it's in the zone. Like there are still guys that do actually pitch and it works for them. And then there are guys who just go up there and throw as hard as they can and you find them on the injured list more often than not.
Yeah. Let's have some fun here. How many pitchers last season, don't look, do you think pitched 200 or more innings in the regular season?
I think it was, I'm pretty sure it's single digits. I want to say four.
Four is exactly right. Zach Wheeler had 200.
Yep.
Logan Webb had 204 and two thirds. Seth Lugo had 206 and two thirds. Logan Gilbert had 208 and two thirds. So have a first or last name that starts with L. Name your kid Logan. Apparently that matters. Logan Gilbert and Logan Webb. I've seen a couple theories here, right? I've seen the idea of the double hook DH. If your starting pitcher doesn't go a certain number of innings, you lose the DH when he comes out. I've seen they floated an idea last year about starting pitcher minimums. You had to go at least five innings unless there was like five or six runs or something allowed. And somebody did the work and it would have changed like one start per team per week because the exceptions were so huge. Is this something that we can reasonably legislate a little bit better without fundamentally changing the game? Because you think about, like, there were some things that we did in the interest of safety, like the universal DH was marketed as a safety thing, right? National League pitchers hitting, breaking fingers, trying to bunt, things like that. They put in the pitch clock. Note, we don't know for a fact that it's not actually hurting in this situation, right? They put in the ghost runner and extra innings as a safety thing to not have to play so many innings and extras. Is there a realistic thing you can do to try to encourage more pitching on average and less effort from starters without making the game, lack of a better term, weird?
No, I like your proposal, and I also did like the double hook DH proposal that has also been out there. I think either one of those would work very well.
Bring back the National League pinch hitter, baby. I miss National League strategy of having to pinch hit late in games for your relievers. But like, I'm thinking about that five pitcher thing. You have a starter listed. You have your closer is probably on that list unless he's down for the day, right? Your closer is probably on that list, and so If it's a blowout one way or the other, let's say your closer pitched yesterday. You want to have him for the series finale tomorrow. You're going to try to find a way to skip him today. So now it's a blowout. You've got to get through with just four pitchers. Like, you're going to have to ask your relievers to pick up multiple innings each. I did see another proposal. I don't have the specifics on it, but it was about limiting the amount, like how much you can move pitchers in and out of the back of the bullpen. I think the anecdote that was given was a dude would cover like three straight days and then they'd option him down or they'd DFA him or whatever, and they'd get a new guy up. And it's like finding a way to cut that down. But it just feels like there's small tweaks you can make to try to incentivize this, but there's no way to force it. There's no way to legislate and say, you have to stop throwing max effort. You just have to encourage things to do that. The other issue I have is I don't know if we can trust the owners and Rob Manfred to do it correctly. It feels like their big takeaway from this segment, because I know Rob Manfred's watching right now, the big takeaway from this segment is going to be, wait, we can just say you can't throw harder than 95? We could do that? And like something like that changes the game in a way that's just weird and dumb. But I feel like there's things you can do to just incentivize at the major league level guys pitching deeper into games, pitching more innings at less effort. But I also don't know how you filter that down to the amateur ranks. I just don't know how you get a high school kid who wants to get drafted and go pro to understand, hey, buddy, you can just go out there and throw 90. Like, it's fine. You don't have to throw 95. I don't understand. I don't know how you do that. And I think that's the big fundamental question that baseball has to figure out if they ever want to fix this pitcher injury epidemic.
Right. Yeah. And like, yeah, I'm with you. I don't think that the owners or Rob Manfred are going to be down for really anything, because just like home runs, chicks dig the long ball, baseball fans dig high velocity on fastballs. And it's people come to see Paul Skenes throw 100 miles an hour, or Jacob DeGrom when he starts throw the slider at 98 miles an hour. And that's what brings people in and brings the eyeballs and the ticket sales. So it's going to be something that probably won't get fixed, even though it is a problem.
This has been First Pitch for Wednesday, December 18th. If you're listening on audio, do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, hit the notification bell so you know when we drop the next episode. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.